We are going to have a financial literacy party this hour. So get out the noisemakers and get on the phone with your personal finance questions for financial planner Kevin McKinley. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, April the 26th. And because April is Financial Literacy Month, Kevin today will have some advice for four key parts of our lives. And again, he will also answer your personal finance questions. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
You know, Kevin, I know that I am more financially literate than I used to be since I've been doing this program with you, but I don't know if I can say I'm actually financially literate. What exactly does that mean?
It's an ever-evolving concept, if you will, because there is so much information out there. You really can't get your arms around it. The best thing to do is try to know what directly affects and applies to you and your situation. And since there isn't any real benchmark or solid parameters of qualifications in which you might be financially literate, I will now pronounce you financially literate.
Yay! I'm so happy. Well, we are going to be spending the hour talking about what we need to know about the most common and most important financial subjects. What are those?
Well, the term financial literacy, Joy, it's slightly misleading, even though it's something I believe in, and Wisconsin is actually the leading state in promoting financial literacy amongst its citizens, in part due to the Jumpstart Coalition and the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. But the term literacy implies knowledge and information, and that it's even the most important factor in your own financial future. And while that is important, the bad news is, as I mentioned, there's too much to know out there. The information is always changing, and even what you're reading may be wrong, and it may even be wrong for you. The good news is what you do is more important than what you know when it comes to money. So we're going to talk about what you need to do in these four basic areas: spending, retirement, housing, and saving and paying for college. And then in each one of these factors, we'll give you some subsets of the three most important things that you need to know and do to help you achieve the maximum level of satisfaction and security.
All right, let's start with spending. I know I get an A in that, we'll get to the rest later in the show. So, spending.
Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but quantity does not equal quality.
Darn it.
Just if you're spending a lot, it doesn't mean you're good at it. It's more important, though. Most of the people who I've worked with in the last 23 years who really have a good handle on their financial situation and whom I would consider to be financially secure, it's not that they make a lot of money or have a lot of money necessarily. It's that they know where their money goes. Less than half of adults, according to the Department of Labor, actually track their spending on a month-to-month basis. You cannot improve what you don't measure. So you need to write everything down. Use tools like Quicken or sometimes Microsoft Money, TurboTax even has some different spending features in it that you can monitor where all this money is going and then track it. And so that you not only know where it's going, but then you can decide where it could be redirected so that it fits with your goals and your needs more appropriately.
And once you've figured out where your money's going, what do you do next?
Well, a lot of people wonder about their own spending because, you know, people, especially Midwesterners, we don't talk about our spending very much with other people. And so many people don't really know what's normal or what other people are spending their money on. And they kind of wonder, am I doing the right thing here, or am I at least doing something that's right for me? So a simple way to do that is to rationalize your spending into fourths and spend a quarter of your income on taxes, like income taxes, Social Security, and Medicare. A quarter on housing, that's your mortgage, your property taxes, homeowner's insurance, or if you are a renter, on your rent. A quarter on living, which is food, utilities, other types of insurance. And then finally, a quarter on saving. That could be saving for retirement or saving for college or even paying for debt Or it could be just saving for something that you want to purchase in the future, like a new car or a vacation.
I can see how that could work for workers, but what about retirees? Can this kind of system work for retirees as well?
It's much trickier when you are a retiree and you only have usually a small amount of income compared to what you were earning while you were working. That income is usually Social Security and maybe a pension. And many retirees worry that they are going to run out of money too soon, or that they're going to run out of life before they get a chance to do all the things that they wanted to do with their money. So an easier way to monitor your spending in retirement and see if you're spending what's appropriate is to add up all of your liquid savings. This would be IRAs, CDs, other retirement accounts, or mutual funds. And then you can spend conservatively a quarter to a half a percent of that amount per month. That's a quarter to a half a percent of that amount per month. So if you're retired and let's say you have $200,000 in liquid assets, you could spend about $500 to $1,000 of that per month. And then you can kind of use that as an allowance. So for, let's say for some month you might have to spend $2,000 for car repairs. Next month, try not to spend anything. Or if you go a month without spending any of those savings, your nest egg, if you will, then you can actually double up the month afterward.
All right, so do I get downgraded, Kevin, because I spend more than 25% on fun?
Well, your definition of fun, Joy, is thankfully not the same definition of fun of every person. So you may enjoy, I think, you know, maybe homeowners insurance premiums are something you really enjoy paying, and so
that's
provide you
right.
a lot of fun.
That's right.
Good
well,
for
we
you.
We will talk about these other important areas that was spending. We will later in the program talk about retirement, then housing, and then saving and paying for college. So we hope you stay tuned. It's a special Financial Literacy Month edition of On Your Money. And we welcome your personal finance questions. We have room for you at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And let's take a call. Our first caller is, I'm sorry, Kathy in Watertown is our first caller. I'm having a trouble with our phone system. I think we have you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I try to never miss this show. And today I have a question. And the first thing he said is, you know, splitting your money in quarters. And it sounds, you know, pretty good. But you should be talking about, are you talking about, Kevin, gross money, you know, like how much your whole paycheck is before they take out FICA and all that stuff? Or are you talking about at the bottom how much goes into your checking account at the deposit? The net, it's called, right?
That's right. Well, first of all, a couple things we should make clear. Thank you very much, Kathy, for your sort of false praise. That, of course, gets your call in much sooner for people who don't listen regularly. Second of all, when I say spreading it into quarters, I don't mean quarters literally, okay? Not 25-cent pieces, all right? Don't break it all down because there's a weight issue there. It can cause some structural damage to your home if you keep any money around. Yeah, it's the gross amount. If you make $4,000 a month, and you'll probably end up paying about $1,000 of that in taxes, income, Social Security, and Medicare, about $1,000 for housing, about $1,000 for living, and hopefully you've got $1,000 for saving for retirement or college or paying off debt or something fun in the future.
Awesome. That's a question that I've never really kind of gotten when all these people talk about money, and I might be the only person that didn't get that, but thank you for clarifying. I really appreciate it.
Kathy, thank you so much for the call. Kevin, you are awesome. And I
good. I'm glad, Joy, because as part of my contract with Wisconsin Public Radio, you are required to say that at least once per hour.
I know. I got it.
And you've really slacked quite a bit in that, so I want you to kind of pick it up.
Now, we are providing the information on the three most important things to know and do regarding our spending, our retirement, our housing, and our college costs. Let's move on to housing, Kevin.
Okay. And this is something that's become much more of a interesting quandary for homeowners and people who are thinking about becoming homeowners, because prices are cheap, but people are worried that prices are going to get cheaper and they're wondering if they should buy now. So this will give you some idea of the best way to handle those decisions. First of all, we definitely need to think differently about the way we perceive homes and value and mortgages. Whereas once upon a time, for several generations, it was a good idea to buy a home just because you almost always made money on it. And that obviously isn't going to be the case for the foreseeable future, although there is one way that future homeowners and current homeowners may be able to make money on their home. Buyers should generally plan on living in a home for at least 10 years to recoup all the costs of buying the home, fixing it up, and then selling it once again before they're really comfortable making that type of commitment to not only buy a home, to get a mortgage. Otherwise, renting is still going to be a better deal for most people, especially people who don't have a lot of extra cash outside of their home to support themselves through a crunch. Do not expect profit on your home, again, except in one case, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And what many people are finding is, yes, mortgage payments, mortgage interest rates are very low. Housing prices are also relatively low compared to the past several years. However, if they do this right, they might find that their property taxes, their maintenance expenses, and their homeowner's insurance could equal or exceed their monthly mortgage payment.
Uh-oh. But let's say someone does feel comfortable in buying a home. How much should we spend?
Well, a good rule of thumb is that the maximum mortgage one should consider is usually about 3 times annual gross income for Kathy for Watertown. So if you make $50,000 a year of gross pre-tax income, you can usually handle at the most about $150,000 mortgage. If you get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage at 5%, that'll be about an $800 monthly payment plus property taxes and insurance. That will end up equaling about 25% of your gross income, again, if you make $50,000 a year.
And then again, your thoughts on obtaining and repaying mortgages?
Yeah, this in Roth IRAs, a couple of things I'm guessing, and I'm only 1% of the magnitude, but kind of like, you know, when Bruce Springsteen is outperforming or something, and he launches into Born to Run, you know, one of the classics that everybody's heard 1,000 times and they want to hear again. This is my sad, pathetic version of those greatest hits. So, yeah, we'll talk about obtaining and repaying a mortgage. It's really the only way that I think long-term homeowners are going to profit. If you have a mortgage, you should have a low down payment for as little as the lender will allow. You should get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. You should pay it off as slowly as you possibly can. If we get inflation, and right now anyone who's filled up their tank of gas in their car or truck sees that inflation coming, if we get more of that, housing prices and the value should eventually rise because dollars are getting cheaper. But the dollars that you're using to repay your fixed rate mortgage are also getting cheaper and staying the same. So that's really the best way that long-term homeowners are probably going to profit, is by having inflation in their housing price while the inflation actually diminishes the value of each fixed monthly payment. If you've paid off your home, it might still be a good time to look at refinancing it and getting a cash out so that you have that cash out to do with it what you wish. And if you can't stand doing that, at least make sure you get a home equity line of credit for the maximum amount of money that the lender will allow.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he is here to answer your questions when it comes to money matters. Your personal finance question is welcome at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We will have more information on saving and spending for college and also retirement coming up later in the program as we celebrate April being Financial Literacy Month during this edition of On Your Money. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is a Financial Literacy Month edition of On Your Money. And our next caller is Todd in Dodgeville. Hello, Todd.
Hello. I have a loan, and I'm making double payments on that loan once a month, and I'm taking the double payment and the second payment and applying that directly toward principal. What I'm wondering in how the interest builds up on that, my best way to utilize a double payment, whether I do that once a week, if that helps, or once every 2 weeks. And I don't understand how that interest works that way, and I'm wondering how I can utilize my double payment a little better.
Sure. Good question, Todd, and good for you. What type of loan is it?
It's a mortgage on the home.
Okay, just a regular 30-year fixed-rate mortgage or an adjustable rate?
A 15-year fixed rate.
15-year fixed rate, okay. And are you paying that off because it feels good to get it paid off, or are you paying it off because, you know what, you looked around and you really don't have any better use for the money?
I actually have the money already. I have my cushion of money. And I just want to get this paid off as soon as possible because I have the extra money. But I do not want to pay it off right now because I like to have the little extra cushion in case something happens.
Good for you. I like the way you think. Are you maxing? Are you working right now?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Are you maxing out your? I know this wasn't even the question that you answered, but or that you asked. But are you maxing out your retirement savings like Roth IRAs or IRAs?
Yes.
Or 401ks? You are doing that. Okay, good. Yes. For you. What does your lender say when you are kind enough to send them some extra money above and beyond what they're expecting? Do they automatically apply it to the principal, or what do they do with it?
I don't give them a chance. I just tell them that that's what I want done, and I get a smile.
I'll bet you
yours.
Do,
Todd. Uh-huh. What I would do is ask the lender how they're doing that. Obviously, the more rapidly you pay down the principal, the less interest you'll pay overall, and the sooner in the smaller increments that they'll allow you to do it and apply to the principal, the less interest you'll pay too. So, in other words, if your choice is paying, let's say, a payment every 2 weeks versus a payment every week, you are probably going to minimize the interest charges somewhat. It's not going to be dramatic, but by doing it more frequently. So if they'll let you do it more frequently and really actually apply the extra payments to the principal, usually you have to make those instructions very clear, then more frequent, smaller payments will generally cost you less in interest over time than one big payment.
So that is true. If I was to split this once a month up and it's okay with the banker and split that down to do that once every week, that does help on the interest?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially if you're paying ahead. I mean, if you were for some reason like delaying, like you, let's say your mortgage payment were $1,000 and your choice is either to pay $1,000 per month or $250 a week for simplicity. And then let's say when your mortgage payment was due, you just said, no, I'm just going to give you $250 right now, and then I'll give you $250 next week and the week after, et cetera. That won't work. What will work is if you said, well, I know I have a mortgage payment of $1,000 due 30 days from now, but I'm going to give you $250 this week, $250 next week, the week after, et cetera. That should reduce the interest cost somewhat. But again, you have to make sure that the lender is applying that appropriately and then reducing the balance on which they charge the interest appropriately as well.
Good luck to you, Todd. Thanks a lot for the call. Bud in Sturgeon Bay is with us now. Hi, Bud.
Hi, guys. You know, I always enjoy listening to you. You add a little levity to what would otherwise be a very painful conversation.
I agree.
That's right. I was going to be a funeral director, but I decided this would be appropriate.
Oh, you would have shined there too, baby. There should be some
everybody
in the place.
There's that second career.
Yeah. He puts the fun in funeral. Right, I got it.
Okay. I like it. My wife and I have recently been fine-tuning our portfolio, and we've engaged the efforts of a financial planner to more or less give us access to institutional-grade funds. One of the things this guy is recommending are ETFs, which are exchange-traded funds, as mm-hmm. part of both our larger 401k IRA retirement funds, and also sure. as part of our flash money, our rainy day funds. Mm-hmm. Now, he says there's a number of different kinds that are both very risky. You know, they range just like stocks from very risky to pretty conservative. My question to you, Kevin, since you know more about this than I do, I've understood by reading that some of these have a short position. And it might be a dangerous thing to get involved with an ETF, either at our flash money level or at the retirement fund level. Is his choice of funds, is he accurate about that? Are they pretty safe?
Well, it depends. And you have an accurate reading in the sense that some can be relatively conservative and some can be relatively risky. ETFs are exchange-traded funds that are kind of like mutual funds, like most of us own in 401ks or IRAs or just in our separate investment accounts. The difference is between what we're used to is ETFs trade like stocks, and they trade all day, every day, for either during the normal market hours usually, whereas normal mutual funds, like, say, the Vanguard 500 index fund, that typically can only be bought and sold one time during the day, at the end of the day, really, and at that particular price. And ETFs definitely have their advantages. One of the disadvantages of ETFs is, like all mutual funds, we have no idea what is really in that mutual fund at any given moment. And by short, you mean where they've taken a position where they may be betting that the price of an index or security is going down, correct?
Right, or a derivative kind of thing, yeah.
Derivative, sure. That's not bad in and of itself. It only has extra potential risks and rewards that and expenses that you otherwise might not have. It's no different than saying, well, you're really dumb to pay your homeowner's insurance policy premiums because your house probably isn't going to burn down. Yeah, that's probably true if your house doesn't burn down, but that's not why you buy homeowner's insurance. You buy it in case your house burns mm-hmm. down. And some of these funds or ETFs that have short positions are protection against a drop in security prices of a particular index for it. So it's not that there's anything wrong with them. Nothing whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, they're fairly sophisticated depending on the type. But it just means that you have to know what's inside of them, when you can know that, and then understand them well enough to say that, oh, wait, you know, if this doesn't work out for whatever reason, I knew why. And I wouldn't put, you know, the 100% of all your liquid investable assets in something like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Did I pass the literacy test?
Yes, you did. Flying colors, Bud.
Okay, thanks, you guys. Keep it up.
Thank you very much, Bud, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, and he puts the fun in funeral. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We will get to some of the most important things to know about retirement and college in just a moment as we are celebrating Financial Literacy Month here during On Your Money. David and Marinette is with us next. Hi, David. I'm sorry, it's Dave. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. I got a question for Kevin. A friend of mine wants me to pull out a substantial sum of money and invest in physical silver. He says, with the devaluing dollars, that's probably the only way to go nowadays. Now, he's not an investor or nothing. He's just watching the market. And I was just wondering if this was a good idea. I'm not sure what to do here.
Well, it probably, with the benefit of hindsight, was a good idea, because the last time I checked, I think the price of silver on an ounce basis is probably up about, I don't know, maybe 200 or 300% in the last few years for sure, and 100% or more in the last few months. There are a couple issues with that, though. The first one being is that what are you actually trying to do with this money? If you are trying to bet on the rise in price of silver, sure, you should buy physical silver. If you say, no, I'm trying to save for retirement or pay off loans or keep some rainy day money aside, having it all in one type of security that is very volatile and can be very speculative and is very difficult to get physical delivery of and then get it back in and sold quickly, yes, it might be nice for a small portion of your assets, but in terms of betting the farm on it, I wouldn't say that's any better than, you know, buying gold or buying one particular share of stock and putting all your money in that. So it can be a nice little hedge against inflation, but it has ramped up already a lot in price, and that can end fairly quickly if there are a lot of speculators who have built that up in a short period of time.
Okay, yeah, because I wasn't quite sure how he wanted me to take quite a bit. I didn't want to dump everything into it. So, okay,
maybe he has the silver already, Dave, and he's probably trying to get you to boost the price up for him. Do you think, is that a possibility, or is he a better friend than that?
He's a better friend than that. He's just got his silver. So
okay,
I'm
good.
But I'm not sure. I mean, I'm talking, you know, not a lot, maybe $40,000, $50,000, but that's, you know.
That sounds like enough to me.
<That's>
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, Kevin, be wary about that, right?
Yes, I would. And even then, the more liquid any type of commodity investment is, whether it's you're buying silver or gold or copper or tungsten, the more difficult it is to actually demonstrate that you really have what you think you have. And I think there are going to be issues with physical delivery of some of these commodities that people think they own a certificate that represents, say, 1 ounce of one precious metal or barrel of oil or whatever. And lo and behold, that particular underlying commodity is difficult to track. And so then taking possession of it is one solution to that. However, that also adds a lot of friction to the transaction, so you better be comfortable holding those silver ingots or whatever for a long time.
April is Financial Literacy Month, and we are discussing the three most important things to know about some of the most important areas of our lives. We've already talked about spending and housing. Still to come, retirement and college. Let's move on to retirement, Kevin.
Yep, and this is obviously something, a big question on a lot of people's minds right now, both if you're thinking about retiring at someday or if that someday is going to be soon. So let's start with the one that everyone asks us about, really wants to know. In your 60s, you need 200 times your net monthly expenses to retire comfortably. I'll say that again. You need to have savings worth 200 times your net monthly expenses. So if you add up your typical monthly expenses, then you subtract any pension and Social Security payments you expect to get, and then multiply that remaining number by 200. So if you do what we said to do in the beginning of the show, add up all of your typical monthly expenses, and that is $4,000. And then you're going to get, say, state pension and Social Security that totals $3,000. You take $4,000 minus the $3,000. You're left with $1,000 that you need to cover on your own. Multiply by that 200 factor, and then that means you need to have about $200,000 in savings before you can support that monthly expenses. If you want to be financially independent, you want to win the lottery and say, how much do I need to walk away from here at any given moment? That number should be about 300 times your net monthly expenses. And we'll talk about this again, but in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, you should have a factor of respectively of 25 times, 50 times, and 100 times your net monthly expenses in your 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Is there, Kevin, a retirement savings investment that's the best one to use?
the good news is there are several. The bad news is it depends on your individual situation, both now and in the future. But one way that people can decide which vehicle is the best to use between, say, 401ks or 403bs or IRAs or Roth IRAs is to look at line 43 on the 1040. And if that number is greater than $69,000 for married couples filing jointly or $34,500 for singles, you're probably better off using a pre-tax retirement savings vehicle like a 401k or 403b or an IRA. If it's lower than those numbers, you're better off probably using a Roth IRA because you don't get a tax deduction on the Roth IRA, but you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want, and then it will be a tax-free distribution in retirement. The importance of that line 43 on your 1040 is that anything over $69,000 is taxed at 25%, and anything under that is taxed at 15%. So if you're already in that 15% tax bracket, you're probably safe using the Roth IRA. But if you're over that, it's definitely going to be more beneficial for most people to use a pre-tax plan like an IRA or 401k.
Hmm. When should people think about initiating their pension and their Social Security payments?
Well, the old rules were that you always waited as long as possible because then you generally got more money the longer that you lived. And if you were in good health, chances are usually the break-even age is about 78 to 80, depending on your situation. If you made it past those ages, it's almost always smarter to wait to take both pension and Social Security payments. However, these are different times, and the new rules are that sooner is usually better. You should get that money in your hand while you can, and for a couple of reasons. The first one being is that for people who are retiring, it makes it much easier to transition from getting a paycheck to getting a pension and Social Security check rather than your paycheck stopping, and then you draw down all of your savings for this kind of pie-in-the-sky future check that's going to be higher. The second reason that it's better to keep your savings intact and to live off your Social Security or pension payments is that if we do get higher interest rates at some point in the future, you'll be very happy that you kept the savings set aside because you'll be able to invest relatively conservatively in certificates of deposit or treasury bonds or other types of fixed income securities and get a higher rate of yield. But if you've spent all that bridging the gap between your retirement and when you initiate Social Security pension, you won't have any savings for higher interest rates or any other emergencies.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our next caller is Bob in Franklin. Hello, Bob.
Oh, hi. Kevin, I'd like to know what you think about REITs. A few years ago, my mother was talking to buying one, and it's all but tanked.
What is a REIT?
Real Estate Investment Trust.
Oh,
very good. That's correct. What ostensibly a real estate investment trust does is it allows investors to participate, for better or worse, in a pool of real estate. Not a pool, a swimming pool, but apartment buildings, shopping malls, commercial building, can be some other types of residences. And then as the money is then used to purchase these properties, and as those the rents usually flow back through the issuer, they eventually go on to the shareholder. In this case, it was hopefully Bob's mother, but it sounds like due to a lot of factors that your mother hasn't been very well taken care of by this particular investment, right?
Oh, correct. Yeah.
Okay. I hope it wasn't her only investment, that she had other places
she put
her money.
A very small portion, but
okay.
You hate to lose anything, you know.
Well, you hate to lose anything, but I'm guessing, the value of something, painfully in many cases, is really what someone is willing to pay you for it at that given moment. And go ahead.
Is it normal, when we found out it was worth much less than what you paid for it and the interest rate is much lower, I started talking about just dumping it, and it turns out you can't sell them.
There are some that are very illiquid for various reasons. And is it that you can't sell it ever, or you just can't sell it right now, or there's just not a bid on it right now?
I guess written, you're only supposed to sell it back. And, you know, they have rules as far as selling them back. You either have to die or desperately need money or something like that. She gets an offer in the mail once in a while from a company that says they will buy the shares at like 5 or 10 cents on the dollar. And the advice from the broker and the REIT is don't sell your stuff. keep it. You know, it's going to get better.
Well, then good. Then the broker, the dealer, maybe is excited enough to actually take it off her hands themselves at a higher price than what this company is offering to pay it off. I'm guessing that's probably not the case. Let me ask you this. Is it possible, I'm not saying you should do this, but just is it possible to buy new shares of this, like to buy more of that?
Maybe.
Okay.
I haven't really looked into it, but I think so.
Okay, here's what I would say. What's your opinion on the future of the general real estate market, Bob?
Well, I think it's gotten about as bad as it's going to get.
Okay. Let's just say I hope you're right. The best way to make a bad situation a little better is to actually sell it and use the capital loss against any other gains that she might have. Or against future income. And let's say she put $10,000 into that and it's now worth $1,000. If she sells it for $1,000, she can use $9,000 of that loss against any capital gains on which she would otherwise pay taxes. And then anything that doesn't use up, she gets to use $3,000 of that $9,000 loss each year until the $9,000 is used up. So it will at least lower her taxes to reflect the fact that she's taken a loss on it. But she can only do it when she takes the loss. And the reason I ask if she can buy it back again is if you're worried about missing out on some big run-up, which quite frankly I don't think is going to happen. I hope it does for her case and the other shareholders, but I doubt it will anytime soon. She can sell it, take the loss, and realize it. And then at some point she can buy it back. She has to wait at least 30 days after selling it to buy it back. But then if it does go up, she can at least make some money on it. And if, but she can also lock in the loss for future tax purposes. My guess is she's probably going to be better off just selling it and being done with it. These things typically, they're usually so toxic. I mean, let's keep in mind, let's say there's a 90% loss in it. She has to have, 900% gain just to get her money back over time. I don't think that's going to happen. I hope she and you and I live long enough to see that happen. I don't think it ever will. So if you can use the loss, especially if you have other capital gains and income off which offset it, it might be best just to get what you can, lock it in, and be done with it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine. Kevin McKinley is with us as well. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk about saving and paying for college in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you have a question for Kevin, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. And in our final segment of this financial literacy edition of On Your Money, we turn to saving and paying for college. And Kevin, is there a best vehicle, I learned that word today, for saving for college?
Yes. And actually, for many parents and families, the best vehicle is a Roth IRA, surprisingly to many people. But the reason that you need to use a Roth IRA, at least first for saving for college, is that you cannot borrow money to retire. But you can borrow money, or your child can borrow money to pay for college. And then he or she usually has 40 years or so of work to pay it back. So it's better off to save for retirement, max out your Roth contributions, because you can always pull the contribution portion back out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. So if you save in a Roth IRA for 10 years for your 8-year-old, let's say, and then you say, you know what, we're pretty set for retirement, we can help her pay for college, you can pull all that contribution portion back out and use it for college. But if you decide that you need it for retirement instead, it will already be there. You can put in $5,000 plus a spousal contribution of $5,000 as well. There are income limits on it. So if your income is high enough where it precludes you from contributing to a Roth IRA, then you're probably better off using 529 college savings plans. And also grandparents and other relatives are probably better off using those for the benefit of a particular child.
Okay, good. What about student loans?
Yeah, and this is more of this unconventional wisdom. You should generally borrow first to go to college and use your savings last. Most people use savings first and then wait to borrow. And the problem with that is we don't know in 2 or 3 years what the availability of student loans will be and what interest rates will be. And if you have savings set aside at that point, you not only can use it to pay for college, you can even use the savings to pay to make the loan payments to keep the loans current and keep more loans coming if indeed that's the wisest decision for your family. A lot of people are understandably leery of piling up a lot of student loan debt. Right now, I think the average graduate gets out of college, at least ones who have debt, and about two-thirds do. It's about $25,000 to $26,000 that they have accumulated. Mm-hmm. That sounds like an astronomical amount. But you can pay off a student loan balance in 10 years if you just pay 1% of the original balance per month. So someone getting out of school and hearing about, you know, they've got $50,000 in student loans, that sounds horrible. But by paying $500 per month or $6,000 per year, they'll pay that off in 10 years. So a normal 22-year-old graduating from college will be debt-free by 32 and still have that college degree. And most education and degrees are hopefully worth $6,000 or more per year in income. And if they're not, you may want to reconsider if this is the wisest major or course of education for which to borrow a lot of money.
Yeah. Any other advice on paying for college?
Absolutely. Get in, but then get out as soon as possible with a degree. About half the costs that most families and students pay for college are living expenses. Only tuition and books, et cetera, are really only half of the cost. The other half is living expenses. So the longer it takes a kid to get through school, the more living expenses are going to pile up. So that means generally no jobs and taking a full class load and taking winter and summer sessions so that the kid can get out as soon as possible and pay less in living expenses.
And we have a caller who has a question about saving for college, Christina in Iron River. Hi, Christina.
Hi, how are you today?
Very good.
Good. Thanks for taking my call. We had our first child in November, which has just been a joy. And we are looking at putting about $700 that we've received for him of gifts into a savings bond or an IRA, a Roth IRA for college, and I'm wondering what's the best bet for that. Is it to go ahead with a Roth IRA, or is there other options there that we haven't thought of?
Congratulations, Christina.
Thank you.
Yes, Christina, congratulations. And as the father of three children of my own, if you are enjoying the first 5 months of this baby's existence, you're not doing it right. So I'm
well,
going
we've,
to send...
we've had our nights.
Okay, good. That's good to hear, because otherwise I'm going to send protective services over to evaluate. Because if you're really loving this, then something's terribly wrong.
It's a hard job.
Yes. Okay, so you got the $700. It depends on what you want to do. The smartest thing to do, Christina, is if you or your husband have earned income and it's low enough, generally about $170,000 for a married couple filing jointly. If it's low enough, the smartest thing to do is probably put it into a Roth IRA. However, if it's a gift, there's a different philosophical motivation behind the money that was given. And so Then you probably do want to look at a 529 college savings plan with you as the owner and your new – is it a son? Okay, and your son is the beneficiary. The money is always yours until you actually give it to him to pay for college. There are no taxes on the future earnings while it's left in the college savings plan. And when you pull it out for qualified higher education expenses, it's all tax-free. Probably the best one to use, at least to look at, is Wisconsin's EDVEST plan, E-D-V-E-S-T. And that will give you a little tax break on a state basis on the money that you do put in there. We'll have a link up to that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today. But, yeah, that's a good way to start.
Great. Will he be penalized for that when they calculate financial aid when he applies for college?
That depends on the laws 18 years from now and where he goes to school. Technically, under the FAFSA, generally parent-owned 529 plans and sometimes even student-owned 529 plans are not included in the expected family contribution. However, many institutions, once you declare that on the form, and you're required to do so if it's there, you can look at that. They'll look at that and say, hey, come on, we know why that money's there. So before we give you any especially institutional-based aid, you're going to have to come up with some or all of that money first before we give you any need-based aid. But it's better to save and hope that there's aid there rather than not save and then have the aid not be there at all.
Great.
All right. What's your son's name, Christina?
Samuel Jack.
All right. Well, good. Go ahead,
a second,
Kevin.
Christina. If you – I will – give you an extra $100 for his college savings account if you change his legal name to Kevin McKinley.
That chance.
Okay.
Good luck to you, Christina, and to Samuel, and everybody in your family. Let's go next to Tina in Oshkosh. Hello, Tina.
Hi. As a mother of a 22 and a 20-year-old, the headaches don't quit when they start to walk or anything after the first 5 months or whatever. But what I have a question is, our house is paid off. We have a home equity line of credit, and my 22-year-old son is graduating from college this next month. And we were wondering, we did the wrong thing. We used up his savings in the beginning for college. We should have, and he had to take loans out later. Would it be a good idea to help him out until he does get a job, to put it on our low interest line of credit, put his student loans on our low interest line of credit, or let him? We're helping him out with the interest right now, paying off some of the interest. Mm-hmm. Or all of it right away. And I'm not sure, would that be a good idea to do that? And then he can, once he gets a job and is stable, he can start paying off our line of credit.
Is he of sturdy character, hardy stock, and moral fiber?
No.
Thank you for your honesty. I'm guessing almost the vast majority of parents, Tina, will say to you, yes, we agree. He's still a kid, isn't he?
I told you. It doesn't get any easier when they're in their 20s.
No, it's just a different whole set of headaches, and that's just the way it is. That's what you sign on. They don't give you the brochure at the hospital, but to handle a lot of these issues. But here's what I would say. I would say you're better off not paying it off for him. You're better off making the payments for him just so he can keep current on it. Now, what you might want to do is say, hey, you know, you make the payments for it. If you can't make a payment, we'll do it. But what that does is that keeps your home equity line of credit open so that if there is a bigger emergency or he really just flat out can't make the payments, then that money is there for you to use to do that. But otherwise, just make the payments for the time being. It kind of stinks to pay the interest, but the interest rate isn't incredibly high, is it?
I don't think so. Does it sound like 9 or 10% sound high?
Okay, that's high.
Personal loans. They're personal student loans. It's not like staff.
Okay. What's the balance offhand?
I'm not sure. My husband has been doing it, but it's up there. He went to Madison, so it's up there.
Okay. Well, good for him. I went to Madison too, and I'm biased, but I think it's the goodest college in the Big Ten.
It's the goodest one,
right?
Yeah, we have less than a minute, Kevin.
Okay, yeah, I would say just make the payments for the time being until he figures out what he's going to do with the rest of his life. But don't pay it all off, because otherwise, then you've used up some of your excess for him. And if it means paying a little more in interest, so be it. But no, just make the payments. Don't pay it all off just yet.
Tina, thank you very much, and again, good luck to you. The website of the week, Kevin?
It's mymoney.gov. This is the federal government's assistance for all things financial issues that you have with taxes, saving, debt, whatever. It's a huge treasure trove of resource, and more importantly, you paid for it with your federal tax dollars, so you can use it. Mymoney.gov, and we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Well, this was fun. I learned a lot, as always. So four more words before we go.
Well, Carnival and Mardi Gras have nothing on us for Financial Literacy Month here. So, yes, you're right. Spend less and have more.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Chris Molina for producing the programs this morning, and thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.